Hello, it's John Dennis on Wednesday the 17th of June. Today in Tehran, protests continue as the Iranian authorities consider their next move.
There are experts on Iran who believe that this will end with a decision to annul the whole election, to cancel it and start all over again.
Digital Britain is unveiled, guaranteeing broadband internet access for all, thanks to a new tax on telephone lines.
50 pence a month, £6 a year for everybody in the country, which has proved slightly controversial with lots of critical comments.
And a court decision that allowed an award-winning blogging policeman to be unmasked means bloggers have no right to keep their identities a secret.
Where it's public information and it's a public officer talking about his work, there is no right of confidentiality.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's the news headlines and a look at the papers with Bill Overton.
Thousands again protested over Iran's disputed election results in the capital Tehran last night. But observers believe the demonstration outside the state TV station was smaller than over the last 2 days. The country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, dismissed the protests as the work of tension seekers and appeared to rule out any change in the election result, even though some votes may be recounted. And the US President Barack Obama's warned even if the result was changed, there might not be much difference between the policies of the two main contenders for president. Here in Britain, 100 Romanians are sheltering in a church in Belfast after fleeing their homes because of racist attacks. Police helped 20 families, including young children, escape to spend the night in the hall in the south of the city. Community leaders, including the Lord Mayor, have condemned the attacks, which police say involved bricks through windows, youth throwing bottles and making Nazi salutes. A big increase in unemployment to well over 2 million is expected when figures are published later. The Conservatives say they've discovered more than 7 people are competing for every vacancy at job centres. They say more than 19 are applying for every job in lower skilled occupations. The Institute of Managers says redundant workers have only 6 months before they're stigmatised as being unemployed. The Chancellor, Alistair Darling, believes the system of banking regulation doesn't need reforming in spite of the recent crash. In his annual Mansion House speech tonight, he'll say what needs to change is the judgment of regulators. He believes they must look at the financial system as a whole and not just individual banks. In the US, however, President Obama is planning to set up a new system of financial regulation, which he'll unveil today. The Health Protection Agency says there's been a sudden increase in the number of new cases of swine flu across Britain. In the week that saw the first deaths from the disease, more than 220 new cases have been confirmed, 124 of them in the West Midlands. The front pages of the morning papers are a little calmer today. Only The Guardian reports the continuing political battle in Iran, its headline reading, "Silent City, Tehran moves to stifle opposition and media." It also shares a front page story with four others, the new landline tax to pay for broadband rollout. It's the government's announcement that, as the Times puts it, all landlines will be subject to a new £6 levy to pay for the expansion of a high-speed internet network across the country. The Express is angry about it, shouting there's now a tax on every phone being slapped on by the government. The Times, meanwhile, carries a front page picture of Tony Blair saying David Cameron would let him apply for president of the EU if the Lisbon Treaty goes through. The Independent believes that generals go to war over the Iraq inquiry because they don't want it to be a secretive cover-up. And the Mail tells us about the Great Wheelie Bin Rebellion that's spreading across the country against local councils. There's more news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
In Tehran, despite the killing of 7 protesters by Islamic militiamen and the cancellation of an opposition rally, about 10,000 demonstrators again took to the streets yesterday to protest against what they say was a rigged election. About 20,000 supporters of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad attended a rival rally. Iran's powerful Guardian Council says there'll be a recount of votes in areas where the count is disputed, but it's ruled out annulling the election. Our Middle East editor Ian Black has just returned from Iran. He, along with other foreign journalists, had to leave the country on Monday when his visa ran out. He told me how Monday's bloodshed has changed things.
Well, obviously there have been casualties that angers people and galvanises people and makes them more determined, perhaps, than they were before to carry on in pursuit of the goal, at the very least, of overturning this election result, which people insist was stolen and was fraudulent. Although it's interesting from reports that we've been seeing that there hasn't been a repeat of the huge numbers of people on the streets that there were on Monday. We've seen smaller demonstrations. The supporters of Mousavi, Mir Hossein Mousavi, have gathered, despite a call by him not to go onto the streets, but in nothing like the same vast numbers that we saw on Monday. And there's also been a rally organised to show support for President Ahmadinejad, who in fact isn't there. He's attending a conference in Russia.
Who's leading the protesters?
Well, that's a very good question, because I think one of the difficulties of the pro-Mousavi movement is that, I mean, he's there, of course, but it is in effect rather amorphous and leaderless. I mean, we know of maybe 100 people, activists, thinkers, people involved in the campaign who've been taken off the streets, who've been arrested. And certainly when I was in Tehran until 24 hours ago, you could see that when demonstrations took place, they were pretty much happening spontaneously without anybody organizing them. Now, you wouldn't necessarily see everything at all, but there was a striking contrast between the power of the state with all the security forces at its disposal and the nature of the demonstrations, which really did appear to be pretty spontaneous, pretty much sweeping along by their own momentum. Now, that may have changed, and the huge rally that there was on Monday may have generated an ability to organize things more. But it does look, or it has looked at least, like a pretty unequal struggle between the state and the opposition movement.
But there have been some important concessions from the state. We've had an official inquiry into alleged electoral fraud announced by the Supreme Leader, and then a recount of votes in disputed areas. Do these indicate that the regime is insecure?
Well, I think what they indicate is that the regime feels a need to respond in some way to the mass protests that we've seen in the last 48 hours. What we don't know, what's hard to know, is how serious they are in the promises that they're making, how serious the recount would be, how serious any investigation would be. The fact is, there's a mechanism in place through this body called the Guardians Council, which is in effect a bit like the Electoral Commission, say, in this country, which has a statutory responsibility for ensuring that elections are held, you know, with due process. So it isn't clear how much more than that routine function, if you like, is actually been offered. That's the first thing. The second thing is, when any recount or investigation has taken place, how much credibility will it have? If within an hour or so of the election finishing last Friday night, it was announced that Ahmadinejad had won with an unassailable majority, how many people are going to believe the outcome of an investigation mounted by another part of the same system? So this issue of credibility is quite important. To what extent will that diffuse popular anger? I mean, there are experts on Iran who believe that this will end with a decision to annul the whole election, to cancel it and start all over again. It may be that the regime will decide that the cost of supporting Ahmadinejad, who is not the most important player in the Iranian political system, is too great for it to bear, and that at the end of the day he may have to be sacrificed in order to restore things to the way they were before the election.
Ian Black, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/Iran. Also on The Guardian's website today, our film critic Peter Bradshaw picks the 20 best movies coming out this summer. That's at guardian.co.uk/film. A cut-out and keep guide to what to do if you get stung by a jellyfish. guardian.co.uk/travel. And Hannah Poole learns to cook injera. That's a staple dish of Eritrean and Ethiopian cuisine. See what happens at guardian.co.uk/video. Digital Britain was the name of the long-awaited report by Lord Carter on the future of communications in Britain. The White Paper's most controversial proposal is to spend part of the TV licence fee on non-BBC channels. And in a surprise move, landline owners will pay £6 a year to fund the rollout of superfast broadband across the country. The government will upgrade all national radio stations from analogue to digital by 2015, and the new culture minister, Ben Bradshaw, told the Commons it will legislate to curb online piracy.
The government believes that taking someone else's property and passing it on to others without consent or payment is tantamount to theft. Developing legal download markets will best serve both consumers and the creative industries. But we will also legislate to curb unlawful peer-to-peer file sharing.
Media Guardian editor Jane Martinson has the details.
Well, some of the headlines we already knew, which is about trying to get everybody in the UK get access to broadband of at least 2 megabytes. So that was put out in the interim report and finalised yesterday. The new things was an idea to charge everybody to fund the next generation of broadband access. And that's going to mean a 50 pence tax, if you like, a levy on everybody's phone bills, 50 pence a month, £6 a year for everybody in the country, which has proved slightly controversial with lots of critical comments. The other thing that we have found out more about was the government's plans to top slice the BBC. They totally avoided the word top slice, and you will not get a minister using the word about the BBC. But what they have said is that the money used, the part of the licence fee that is currently funding switch over to digital television for the country, is actually going to be, it's continued to fund other providers of news, not the BBC. It's the first time in the history of the BBC they've actually talked about diverting the money away from the BBC that's collected by the licence fee.
And that's going to fund things like children's programmes, ITV, regional news?
The most specific thing that will be funded by that is this area of, local news. They were very clear to say it's about national, regional and local news. But it's essentially the area that's been most hit by the sort of economics, really, of the web, with local newspaper groups particularly worrying about how they can continue, lots of them in sort of dire economic straits because of the advertising downturn, as well as the fact that most people are going online. So that's the first priority, but they have also mentioned another area that they feel is not served under the current regime and will be less served as ITV, other public service broadcasters are sort of released of those obligations. And that's children, specifically older children, actually. The BBC's sort of CBeebies site has generally felt to do a good job, but older children is something that they feel public money should go towards.
What about the future of Channel 4? Because back in January, when this interim report came out, Lord Carter said he supported a tie-up between Channel 4 and BBC Worldwide. Any progress on that?
No, I mean, one of the sort of, well, if you're Channel 4 and wanted some sort of action, one of the disappointing things perhaps will be that after all this time, they're still no better off. And in fact, you could argue that by giving them a wider remit, by saying that Channel 4 needs to do more things, not just television, but, you know, talking about sort of online, how successful they've been online, they've actually sort of not come up with a funding formula, but have said they need to do more things. And they have also left the door open for other commercial ventures, like a tie-up, merger, takeover by Channel 5.
And looking at the Digital Britain report as a whole, I mean, the Tories have described it as a colossal disappointment. I mean, is that a sort of, hyperbole, obviously, but, is that how it's been received in the industry as a whole?
I think generally the reaction has been not entirely positive. The political reaction is interesting because, obviously, if Lord Carter himself is definitely standing down in the summer, the government, a few people are betting that this current government will be the one who will implement much of what he suggested.
Jane Martinson. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, the man who restored the image of the Queen after Diana's death is recruited by Downing Street to become spokesman for Gordon Brown.
The opinion polls, the latest ICM poll in The Guardian, shows that Labour, to put it politely, is struggling. But obviously he is not a party political person. He is a civil servant. He is there to act for the government and for the Prime Minister of the day, whoever that may be.
But first, floods in Manhattan, deaths from heat waves in Chicago, the withering of California's vineyards, the disappearance of wildflowers from the slopes of the Rockies, and polar bears from Alaska. That's what 30 scientists predict will happen if Americans don't act to tackle climate change. They produced a report for the US government into the impact of global warming on the US. And it's part of Barack Obama's plan to build public support for his legislation on climate change. In Washington, Suzanne Goldenberg is our US environment correspondent.
This report is the most comprehensive scientific study so far of the impact of global warming in the United States to date, and of its potential consequences if nothing is done to reduce carbon emissions. So it encapsulates everything, really, from the cost to the economy to public health consequences. It talks about a quadrupling of heat waves in Chicago and other things that will affect human health. It talks about how cranberries could disappear in New England because it'll be too hot to grow them. It talks about storm surges that could swallow up key oil rigs and other installations along the coast of Louisiana. It's really very broad and very detailed.
And what does the president hope this report will achieve?
This is a regular exercise that's supposed to be done by every U.S. government. The Bush administration, however, did not do it. Now, what the Obama administration is hoping, really, in sort of putting its stamp on this report, is really to mobilize public opinion, to help persuade the public that now is the time to act on climate change. And this report is carefully timed. You know, it's released during a week when Democratic leaders in Congress are working really hard to try and pass a climate change bill. So it's all tied together as part of the Obama administration's broader program of energy reform.
Haven't Americans heard these arguments before, though?
You know, having looked at the report and from talking to scientists who have studied it in depth, really, this is the first time that the language has been so easy to understand. This isn't scientific language. It's really, you know, pretty easy reading. It's clearly written. There's lots of colorful graphics. It's very digestible. And also, the Obama administration is sort of putting on a separate PR campaign. They've engaged a PR firm in San Francisco to put together a sort of 20-page brochure on this. So this is really bringing a human face, if you like, to the whole debate about global warming and making it something that can be understood about by everybody. It's not just about abstract science.
And what's your impression, Suzanne? Do you think that Barack Obama is winning the argument?
I think it's too early to say. I mean, he has won praise from all around for linking global warming to the economic recovery. That is, he has put green jobs, the creation of green jobs, at the center of his economic recovery plan, and that's $787 billion stimulus package. But it's too early right now to see how many jobs have been created, let alone green jobs. So in a sense, Obama has tied the economy and the environment very closely together, and he's going to succeed or fail on both at once, I think.
Suzanne Goldenberg. Night Jack was a blog written by a policeman. It attracted hundreds of thousands of readers. And a couple of months ago, it won the Orwell Prize for Blogs. Judges said it was a perfect example of the medium's power and importance. But the High Court ruled yesterday that the blogger did not have the right to keep his identity a secret. Night Jack was written anonymously by Detective Constable Richard Horton, who'd obtained a temporary injunction against The Times. Our legal affairs editor is Afua Hirsch.
Night Jack was a police officer who had been providing behind-the-scenes commentary of life in a police force, and he had around 500,000 followers to his blog, but he used the name Night Jack and kept his identity secret.
And now the High Court has ruled that he's not entitled to do that.
Well, the Times discovered his identity through a process of what they've described as old-fashioned investigative journalism, mainly trawling through information on the web. They actually managed to track down his name. And he then sought an injunction, which was overturned today by the High Court. And what Edie, who's the increasingly well-known expert judge on these cases of privacy and freedom of expression law, said was that he couldn't keep his details secret, and the fact that he wanted to remain anonymous didn't give him a legally enforceable right to remain anonymous.
What are the implications for him?
The implications are that the Times are now free to report his details. And as a result, he said that he's probably going to face disciplinary proceedings inside the police force. Mainly concerns some of the details he's revealed in his blogs, which includes some confidential material about prosecutions. He's also been very outspoken on political issues, condemning some ministers and criticising some government policies on the police, which may be in breach of regulations about what the police are supposed to say publicly.
He's now taken down Nightjack from the internet. Will other bloggers who have hitherto been anonymous have to follow suit?
There's some disagreement in the legal community about whether this judgment actually changes that much, because until now, ISPs, internet service providers, could already provide details of people who are posting material on their sites. So in theory, many bloggers who think they're anonymous already could have been traced. But this means that if journalists get hold of the details, there's nothing to stop them publishing. And it remains to be seen how much this will affect bloggers. Many of them do wish to remain anonymous and try to conceal their identities, but it's a question of whether anyone's really going to try to expose them. What's unusual about this case is that usually when someone's arguing privacy, it's inherently private information. For example, information of a sexual nature, information about a marriage or a family, photos of people's children. But what Edie said in this case was that the material's inherently public, because this is a police officer talking about life in the police and issues with a public interest element. So this is quite an unusual case, because he was arguing that public information should be kept private. And what Edie said now is that that's not the case. Where it's public information and it's a public officer talking about his work, there is no right of confidentiality.
Cristiano Ronaldo's £80 million transfer from Manchester United to Real Madrid might lead you to conclude that football's completely lost touch with reality. But in fact, most clubs are on the brink of bankruptcy. In the latest edition of our business podcast, Aditya Chakraborty is joined by Stefan Szymanski, a professor of sports economics. He says the current model of financing football clubs is unsustainable, although he'd love a Roman Abramovich-like investor to invest in his team, Scunthorpe United.
Well, I'd be thrilled, and I'd be staggered if you could find many football fans who wouldn't be thrilled. I'd love to see Scunthorpe have ridiculous sums of money ploughed into them. Absolutely fine if that's going to get Scunthorpe United to the final of the Champions League. I mean, that's exactly what football's about, surely. It's the fantasy that your team might one day be at the very top of the tree, and that hope which sustains not just me, but many football fans.
Stefan Szymanski. And you can hear more from him on our business podcast at guardian.co.uk/audio. Gordon Brown's new spokesman is Simon Lewis, a former press secretary to the Queen, who helped restore her image after the death of Diana. He's also the brother of Will Lewis, editor of the Daily Telegraph, and an old friend of Lord Mandelson. He replaces Michael Ellam, who'd been Gordon Brown's director of communications since he became prime minister almost 2 years ago. Nicholas Watt, our chief political correspondent, is in Westminster. He says Lewis faces an uphill struggle.
Well, yes, the general election has to take place by June the 3rd next year. The opinion polls, the latest ICM poll in The Guardian, shows that Labour, to put it politely, is struggling. But obviously, he is not a party political person. He is a civil servant. He is there to act for the government and for the Prime Minister of the day, whoever that may be. But he's a close friend of Peter Mandelson. Peter Mandelson believes that the current Downing Street communications operation has weaknesses, and Simon Lewis is designed to help that out. In a sense, the greatest challenge that Peter Mandelson believes is facing this government and this Prime Minister is to really put forward a key, compelling narrative of how this government and this Prime Minister is going to take Britain out of the recession, take Britain out of the downturn. And Simon Lewis, with his background in the palace, but perhaps on this one more significantly, his background in business for Vodafone and Centrica, that he will play a major role in that, so they hope.
And how easy is it going to be for Simon Lewis to fit into Gordon Brown's team at number 10?
Well, there's not a happy story of outsiders coming in and working in this Downing Street. The classic example of that would be that when Gordon Brown decided to reorganise the Downing Street operation after the famous election that never was, Tom Scholar, who was his chief of staff, who he'd brought over from the Treasury, went back to the Treasury, and Stephen Carter was brought in to be the director of strategy. That didn't work. Stephen Carter was shunned by the inner members of the Brown Circle, and at the reshuffle in October last year, Stephen Carter left, was given a peerage, became the communications minister, and indeed yesterday published the Digital Britain white paper, but he's now leaving the government next month. So it hasn't been a happy story for outsiders coming in, but I think there are two big differences here. One, Gordon Brown has been shaken to the core by Labour's disastrous electoral performance in the European elections, 15.7% of the vote, and he knows he needs to mend his ways. And the second thing is that it's pretty obvious that Peter Mandelson is playing a pretty important role in refashioning Downing Street. This Simon Lewis appointment has the fingerprints of Peter Mandelson all over it. So I think it will be different to the Stephen Carter appointment, and I would imagine that Simon Lewis will be on much stronger ground.
And Simon Lewis replaces Michael Ellam. Tell us about him.
Well, Michael Ellam is a long-serving aide of Gordon Brown's. First came to his attention when he was Director of Communications at the Treasury. That's a post that is always held by a high-flying Treasury official because you have to handle sensitive economic data. Transferred to Number 10 with the Prime Minister in 2007 to become his press secretary. Michael Ellam is highly respected by journalists who cover British politics. He's very straight. Some members of the Brown Circle are not seen as being straight. They're seen as being a little overly aggressive. Not the case with Michael Ellam, very straight. But I think privately he'll be absolutely delighted to be going back to the Treasury. That is his natural habitat. Are quite keen to put a little bit of distance between themselves and Gordon Brown as we run up into the next general election. It's always difficult for civil servants who've worked close to a Prime Minister if there's a change of government, but particularly so with Gordon Brown because he is seen as a deeply partisan figure by the Conservatives. They believe he politicised the Treasury.
Nick Watt. Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.